information, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
So let's look, therefore, to see a secret society that really should be talked about. We could be here all day. There are, you know, there's stuff like Skull and Bones and Kappa Phi Beta and etc., etc. But let's just take one. This is an image from an organisation called the Bohemian Club. Now, the Bohemian Club was founded in California in the late 1800s and quickly became, you know, initially it was for artisans, really, but it quickly became very popular with politicians and rich industrialists and all of this. And they bought some woods, which they christened Bohemian Grove. And once a year, they would perform this ritual beneath a giant stone owl, where they would sacrifice the effigy of a child to the owl, as you do, you know. And this was called the cremation of care. Now, I know many of you will be aware of this, but if you're not, maybe at this point you're thinking, well, yeah, but you know, they did weird things in the Victorian days. Well, of course, the thing is that this ritual still goes on today, every year, at Bohemian Grove. And then you look at the roll call of the people that turn up, and it's pretty impressive. Your Bushes, your Blairs, your Cheneys, your Kissingers, your Nixons. Anybody who is anybody, sooner or later, shows up at Bohemian Grove. And we know this because there are so many whistleblowers who have actually decided to find out more about this. And in fact, the reason that we know as much about it today as we do is not due to a conspiracy theorist. It's due, in fact, to this man here. This is John Ronson. He's essentially a skeptic, but he's interested in people with unusual ideas. He's a journalist for The Guardian. He's a TV presenter. You will have seen him from time to time. And Ronson was persuaded by an American conspiracy theorist called Alex Jones to break into the Bohemian Grove compound while this was going on. Now, they weren't the only ones ever to break in, but they were certainly the ones that took it the most publicly, if you wish. And Ronson, in fact, made this the basis of a chapter in his best-selling book, Them, Adventures with Extremists. But even he accepts that it's a bit of a weird thing for our world leaders to be doing, you know, dressing up in bunny robes and worshipping giant owls. So this is where it starts to get a bit weird, because of course you could argue it's just a harmless pageant. But others say if you look at the big decisions that get made there, there's more to the story. For instance, the first meeting to discuss the Manhattan Project, which developed the first atomic bomb, of course, took place at Bohemian Grove. And this is where you realise that actually a lot of the decisions that are made about our world take place far outside the eyes of democracy. I mean, you must know most of this, but if you don't, I mean, look at things like the Bilderberg Group. This is where real power lies. The Trilateral Commission, the Tavistock Institute, the Club of Rome, the Council on Foreign Relations. You can add Common Purpose and all these other things into the list if you wish. These are the think tanks and the quangos that really hold power. By the way, George Osborne, our current Chancellor, is a major attender of the Bilderbergs. So we have a Bilderberg member right at the heart of government, but don't feel that's anything special, because most governments have them. And it's almost as if this is where the real decision-making happens, and then what they decide is then filtered down to our illusions of democracy. Make no mistake. And by the way, this is mainstream now. Even, I think it was The Guardian, again, started reporting the Bilderberg meetings a couple of years ago. With some concern, saying, well, hang on a minute, this is clearly important, but nobody gets to say. It's utterly undemocratic. So there's no question at all that real power lies in places that are not made public. So this is, of course, why some people then begin to say, well, what can we trust? How can we rely on anything? Who is running the world? And this is a problem. When you start to question everything, you're then left with nothing, in a way. What do you believe in? What is reliable? Are we ever told the truth? And the answer is, probably not.
So it's not funny.
So let's just take a conspiracy theory as an example. One classic one. Right, and just apply the truth agenda to it. Because it's just a good example of something we've all taken utterly for granted, and also, it's a conspiracy theory we've all been very encouraged to laugh at. You must know this one. The conspiracy theory that we never went to the moon. And that in fact it was all faked in a studio. Now, I mean, it's so common knowledge, you know, this is joked about in The Simpsons, you know what I mean? This theory. But what is interesting is when you actually start to look at some of the evidence that questions the moon landings, it's actually quite persuasive. Now, you've got three bits of evidence that we went to the moon. Number one, you've got the astronauts' testimony. But people have been known to lie. There's a lot of contradictions, by the way, in the astronauts' testimony. Some say, for instance, the stars in space were amazingly bright. Others say you couldn't see the stars, they were like meaningless pinpricks. A lot of contradiction. But also people lie under oath or under threat. Who knows? So you can't be quite sure. So you've got to put that aside for the moment. So what else do we have? We've got moon rock. So we're told moon rock proves we went to the moon. Well, of course, the problem with that is, number one, if somebody hands you a rock and says, that's from the moon, how are you going to know, you know? Interestingly, when a Dutch museum finally analysed their claim moon rock a couple of years ago, it turned out to be petrified wood. So what we're told is moon rock may not be moon rock. However, if it is moon rock, of course, that's not necessarily a problem because it might have been retrieved by robotic probes. That doesn't prove that people stood on the moon. So therefore, what have we got to prove that we went to the moon? The photos. And only the photos. It's the only serious evidence that we've got. So they'd better stand up to some pretty damn good scrutiny. But the kind of annoying thing is that they don't. Well, if you just take this classic picture of Buzz Aldrin, one of the most famous photos ever taken, this is a good starting point. So what are the criticisms of this? Well, number one, some people have pointed out that, okay, here's Buzz Aldrin on the moon. Now, clearly you've got the light, presumably the sun, coming from behind, and it's casting a jet black shadow on the ground. Now, there's all sorts of arguments about shadow angles and all that, that are really by the by. You don't need all that to make a case. But what is interesting is this. You will see he's got a jet black shadow, which is fairly correct, and yet his body is fairly well lit up. You can see a lot of detail on his body. Now, the claim for this is that what you're seeing is reflected light off the surface of the moon. But there's a problem here, because if that is the case, there should be enough reflected light to show up some detail in the shadow as well. Now, this is not a unique picture. There's many pictures with deep pools of black shadow, and yet the object, backlit, is all nicely lit up. So this is just one of many showing this effect. Now, of course, there is another way you could get this amount of light, which is you raise the exposure of the camera. Okay, fair enough. But if you were to do that, again, not only would he be gleaming white, there would be plenty of detail visible in the shadow. Not, again, this weird effect of one and not the other. And if you raise the exposure, the whole lunar surface would be bright white. And yet, if you look, as you've already maybe noticed, what's weird is you've got a bright pool of light around in here. The light falls off almost into shadow in the background, almost shadow in the foreground. Now, this is a flat area. That's why they landed there, because it was flat. And that's a problem. And some people say that what you're looking at here is a spotlight, because it's really the only thing that can explain this anomalous pool of light. If you photograph somebody standing on the beach tomorrow, you don't have a bright spot of light from the sun there and then darkness all around. It's a uniform light. And on the moon, there's not even any cloud or atmosphere. So there's nothing to scatter light. It should be one straight light. Clearly, it's not working like that here. There's a number of NASA pictures that show this spotlight effect. Now, you could say, well, all right, they took artificial lighting. But they claim they didn't, you see. They say no artificial lighting was used. So there is an anomaly. Number two anomaly. Now, you can see here that in the reflection of the visor is Neil Armstrong taking this picture of Buzz Aldrin. Now, you can see, when you look closely, that this is one of, as most of them were taken, if the picture's taken from a chest camera, is a camera strapped to the chest. I'll show you it in a minute. So this was taken at chest height. Well, a lot of people have pointed out, if this was taken at chest height by this man, the horizon line that passes very aesthetically pleasingly through the middle of the visor actually should come about here, through his middle. And people have gone away and done tests, and there's no question. The horizon should go through his middle. The only way the horizon could be here is if this was taken from about 5-6 feet up looking down. But you can see from the reflection that it wasn't. So this is an impossible angle if it was taken by Neil Armstrong. And again, there's many lunar shots that have this problem. So, the more you start to look at it, the more you think, yeah, there are some anomalies here. Here's the camera they use, a classic 60s Hasselblad. It was pretty basic, by the way. It had no viewfinder. So they took all of the pictures on a wing and a prayer, going click, click, never looking through it nor knowing what they were seeing. And yet the miracle is that the majority of pictures are near perfect.
Yeah.
Whereas if you wander around Brighton tomorrow doing that, you might lop the odd head off somewhere, you know what I mean? So that is in itself strange. So there you can see it strapped to the camera. They were operating with pressure gloves, like cricket gloves, barely able to do much but the basic click. So that in itself is weird. They never bracketed for exposures. What that means is that when they first stood on the moon, they didn't try a number of different exposures to see what worked. They just started going click, click, click. And miraculously, they got it right first time. Now, this is the 60s we're talking about here. 60s technology, not today's modern cameras. So, and there's another horizon anomaly. And you can even see here, it looks like somebody's literally cut and pasted that reflection shot onto the picture.
Yeah.
Another shadow anomaly, jet black, nicely lit up. The more you start to look at the lighting, it's a problem. Here's the lunar lander, and there plainly is the sun, we believe. So it casts a nice big jet black shadow, but hey, look at all the lights playing here, and very helpfully somebody's added in the arrow showing where the light's coming from. And it comes directly in from the side. When you zoom in on these pictures, you can see little spots, reflective spots, so you can see exactly where the light's coming from. And the astronaut, I mean, he's gleaming white. That is not light bouncing off the surface. You can see it's coming straight in from the side. There's no way there could be that much reflected light. That should be a silhouette.
Yeah.
Now, there's something else wrong here, which is the truth of many of these pictures. Now, in none of the shots of the lunar lander, do you ever see any sizable crater or scorch or disturbance? Now, the official story is they cut the retros before they touch ground. So, okay, you could imagine initially it's coming down on a big jet of flame and then they cut the retros. But when it comes down, it's still going to go thwomp. All the astronauts said, moon dust went everywhere. You read the testimony, say, you kicked it up and it flew up and it took ages to go down. There is no footage that shows that happen anywhere, by the way. All the videos show the dust going straight back down. But here's the thing, is that even allowing for the no retros, there should be some dust. You look at the close-ups of the feet in all of the missions, six missions of photos, it's just absolutely clean, as if they vacuumed it.
Pristine.
Compare that to the recent Mars Phoenix lander, which shows what you would expect. A bit of dust on the foot. Now, nobody doubts the robotic probes because there's no real reason to fake that. And it's easier to keep a device going in space than it is a human being. There's a problem here. And, I mean, this is the thing. The more you start to look, the more you think there are anomalies which shouldn't be there. Here is John Young from Apollo 14 saluting the flag. And what he's done here is leapt up. So he's momentarily, allegedly in the low gravity, sort of suspended. Now, this was videoed at the same time from a camera. You can just see it there if you look closely on the buggy. So we can see this from the front and the back. The videos are just as dodgy as the photos, by the way. Well, that really is for another time, but we will just look at this. So we have a rear view and a front view. But even allowing for the reverse angle, what immediately is apparent is that he is hanging quite a different angle to the one we see here. The flag is at 70 degrees there, 90 degrees there. There is a whacking great flap sticking up from the... It can only be the back of the backpack. And yet it's barely sticking up at all there. And the clincher is this. In the video, there's a big puff of dust. You can just see it there, comes up from under his feet. In the still shots, and these are really high res when you look at the real shots, there's nothing. There is no dust. This is a different moment. They've restaged it. Now, you could argue that's okay. But why didn't they say they'd restaged it? They fob us off that this is the same moment, and it very plainly isn't. Now, if you struggle to believe that NASA would ever have faked an image, have a look at this. This is Michael Collins, allegedly spacewalking from Gemini 5. and in the mid-60s this would be, and this was taken as such for many years until somebody, looking through the NASA image bank one day, came across this picture and said, oh, that's a bit weird, look. There's Michael Collins in a test aeroplane. And clearly all they've done is just, they've cut him out, stuck him on a black background and said, oh, he's in space. Look. It's that cheap. It's that cheap. And the other classic shot is the astronauts playing golf on the moon. That is, you can prove, Mary Bennett and David Percy in their book Dark Moon, they prove all the different images they cut and pasted it from. It's a composite shot they completely invented. This is just an example. So we have to conclude from this that if nothing else, some of these images are fake. Now, does that mean we didn't go to the moon? No. Some say we didn't. Some say the radiation was too much, nobody could survive, the films perhaps couldn't survive. Others say the films didn't come out because of the radiation and the heat and the cold and the extremes. Maybe they had to fake them because the pictures didn't come out and they needed some evidence. Others, of course, say that they couldn't actually show what they really found. Because when you consider that Edgar Mitchell from Apollo 14 says they found evidence of ETs on the NASA missions, you have to wonder what it was they really saw. You have to make up your own mind, basically. But there's certainly something not right at the core of this. And I urge you to look at this website. Later on, by the way, when you go, there's some leaflets you can take on the table with some websites to follow some of this up. But look at allist.com and read what they call the Jack White studies. And I guarantee you, having read those, you will never see the moon landings in quite the same light again. Because at least some of those images are provable fakes. By the way, if you want two good books to read, that's probably the best, One Small Step. Astonishing read, well researched. And Dark Moon is like the classic, a bit esoteric, but very interesting. And see, the problem is we are lied to. We know we are lied to. We are lied to regularly and in a very large fashion. Everybody accepts this. And the whole weapons of mass destruction thing really tipped that into the public domain. I never mind WikiLeaks. I mean, WikiLeaks is a kind of a distraction, I think, from what the big stuff really is. And many people think WikiLeaks is in itself being manipulated. Yeah. That's another story. But the weapons of mass destruction, everybody knew in their collective gut that there was something wrong about that war. That's why millions took to the streets to protest about it. And, of course, in the end, we did still go to war, but you may recall back at that time, and I know this is taking Coles to Newcastle, probably, but, you know, people like Dr. David Kelly said, there's no weapons of mass destruction. Yeah. Kelly was one of their top men. Of all people who would know, it was David Kelly. And yet, as soon as he went to the BBC and told the journalist Andrew Gillingham, there are no weapons of mass destruction, his name was released to the press by basically the Blair administration. He was vilified and described by one of the Blair people as a Walter Mitty-like fantasist. Now that's a bit weird, because only the week before he'd been one of their top men. And suddenly he was a fantasist. And suddenly then he was dead, of course. And you know the story. So he's found dead in the woods, and allegedly it's suicide. And yet, when you look at the evidence, you simply cannot conclude that that can be the real answer. Even Norman Baker, MP, up the road in Lewis, has written a book, as I'm sure you're aware, The Strange Death of Dr. David Kelly, in which he proves that Kelly could not have committed suicide. The wounds shouldn't have killed him. The drugs shouldn't have killed him. His body was provably moved from where it was originally found and then dragged into a better position for the police shots. There is so much that is wrong. There was a strong police presence before Kelly was even reported missing. When you look at the overall case, you have to conclude we've not been told the truth of it. And the fact that Lord Hutton has now announced that there will be a 70-year embargo on anybody ever seeing the medical records.
Yeah.
Well, what does that tell you? Mm-hmm. What does that tell you? Because they don't want you to see them, because it obviously does not prove what they say, which is that he committed suicide. He said to his friend a few weeks before he committed suicide, he said, well, if it goes on like this, he said, I'm soon going to be found dead in the woods.
He did say that, yeah.
And he actually used that phrase. It's a bit like Diana saying to her butler, Paul Burrell, they want to kill me in a staged car crash. But of course, there was no conspiracy there, was there? Anyway, What I'm saying here is that, of course, that we know we're lied to. And everyone in their gut knew there was something wrong with the story. Now, there's probably about 10% of people that believe he committed suicide. Most people in public went, oh, well, they bumped him off, didn't they? Because we know. There is a collective consciousness. We know when something's not right. And often that's where you find the general truth. Now, the weapons of mass destruction thing, of course, was a spin-off, effectively, from the War on Terror. And the whole Afghanistan disaster and the war in Iraq and all of that spun off, of course, from the War on Terror, which span off, of course, from 9/11. Now, I know many of you here will be aware of the issues surrounding 9/11, so I won't spend very much time on this. But you have to acknowledge that out of all the modern conspiracy theories, the 9/11 one has got the most going for it.
Yeah.
You can dismiss some. You can dismiss some because there's not much evidence and it's just hearsay and you've only got a little bit here and a little bit there. 9/11 is different. There are so many anomalies that stack up and up and up. It gets to the point where the stack's toppling, because there are too many anomalies to ignore. Now that doesn't mean we know for sure what happened, but there bloody well needs to be some proper investigation, which we've never had.
They won't allow it.
Of course they won't. Well, let's briefly look at this. What are the key issues around it? So the contention is, in the conspiracy world, that Al-Qaeda either were nothing to do with it or didn't act alone. I suspect the latter, personally. They didn't act alone. They were patsies. Okay? Now, the thing is, of course, that means somebody within the US administration must have been pulling strings to make this attack as successful as it was. And maybe that's no big deal to you. You say that to some people. It's a massive blow to their view of the world. And yet, that's what the evidence suggests. So, I mean, the first thing that really got noticed was, in fact, the Pentagon. The hole in the Pentagon was the first thing that began to get people talking about this. We are told it was hit by a 757. And yet, the entry hole for the 757 is very small. Its main entry point is only around 20 feet across.
It must have lost its wings before it crashed.
Let's look at one. There we go. That's a 757. Now, okay, it was a little bit of damage either side, but the main entry point, and you can see here, in fact, at first the walls had not collapsed. These are not wheels, by the way. This is stuff that was already there on the lawn. There's no debris visible, nothing like that. People in the Pentagon said what was weird was there was hardly anything there. There were no seats or suitcases or body parts. It was like nothing. And people on the day said, and there are live broadcasts preserved, saying, no, it was small. It was a small aeroplane. Others have said a missile. And it sort of then got changed to, no, it was a 757. And they've repeated this over and over again. They've never released any official footage that definitively shows a 757 hitting this building. It just shows a street. Could be anything. And, I mean, basic trigonometry alone suggests that there should be damage at least 164 feet either side. Well, there isn't. Even the angle this plane took to hit the Pentagon is very strange. It managed to perform one of the most extraordinary aerial acrobatics in history. Because it dropped 7,000 feet in less than 2 minutes.
No.
Turning this very tight curve. Now, there's now an organisation called Pilots for 9/11 Truth. Because even they, right, just couldn't sit still for this anymore. Because they said, that's not possible in a 757. We're told it was travelling at 500 miles per hour. Pilots have said it would just break up. If you turned a curve at this altitude, the engines aren't even meant to work at those speeds at that altitude, bear in mind. It just would break up in the air. But it didn't, oddly. And it managed to do this to go out of its way, instead of just heading straight down into the middle, great big bullseye. But no, it has to turn this curve to hit the one part of the Pentagon that was under renovation at the time. Well, funnily enough, there weren't that many people in it. Almost as if they wanted, you know, some casualties, but not too many. Not here. Doesn't matter about the Twin Towers, everyone can go there, but not here. And what is even more extraordinary is we're told that at the helm of this plane was this gentleman here, Hani Hanjour, an Al-Qaeda terrorist, who even the flight school that inadvertently trained him said was not able to handle a light aircraft. And yet on 9/11, we are told, he managed to perform one of the most historic aviation acrobatics.
But that is something a missile could possibly do, though.
Well, of course, lots of people think it was a missile or a small plane. And I think that's more likely. And the reason is, when you look at pictures of the debris inside, and people have analysed this, the little bits you can see seem to match an A3 Sky Warrior, which is a rather obscure American fighter. And it's more than likely that's what they use. The wheels, which you can see, by the way, come up to about here. And then you see a photograph of a 757 wheel, which is kind of up here. So we certainly have not been told the truth about the Pentagon. What did then happen to the plane that supposedly hit it? That's too big for today. There are many interesting discussions about that. So what about the towers? Well, you know the main story, the fires and the damage weaken the structures and they pancake down. But I'm afraid there are so many architects, engineers and physicists who are now challenging this that at the least it must be properly looked at. Because when you start to analyse the way it all came down, and I urge you to go onto Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth website and watch Richard Gage's presentation about the laws of physics and the collapse of the towers, because he said that if nothing else, there should have been an unevenness to the collapse. Sooner or later it should have stopped itself or at least gone off to one side and all of this. Instead, they pretty much come down into their own footprint very, very neatly. And there are so many things wrong, and I don't want to harp on too much about this today, but the basics of it are this, that the pile driver theory, which says that, okay, the weakened floor suddenly collapsed in, and then the top bit pushed down and down, floor by floor by floor, is plainly bollocks. Because you can see it's not happening like that. When you see the footage, the tops of the towers explode.
Yeah.
They don't come down, they literally blow up, throwing debris so far away that they were still finding human remains on the tops of skyscrapers 6 years later. Such was the force of these explosions. So it's not a natural fall. They fall also at near free fall speed, which means as fast as anything can go in normal circumstances. And that's important because there is something to consider here. When you look at the footage, again and again, you see things that look suspiciously like demolition charges going off.
Yep.
Now, the official explanation is that what this is a pressure wave of air pushing down from the pile driver that isn't there, but from the pile driver pushing the air down, and that this is office materials and stuff spilling out of the window. Well, you can see these are substantial explosions. And some of these are so far down that the pressure wave, given that it's all coming down at free fall speed, couldn't possibly have got that far down there. So what is causing these explosions that you see far below, which I'll show you properly in a second? And then when you look at real footage of a demolition, there's a tower block in Philadelphia a few years ago, it's uncannily similar. Because, of course, one of the contentions is they couldn't have just fallen by themselves. The buildings must have been laced with explosives to make sure they came down with maximum effect. And when you look at the moving footage, it really does support that. Watch this. Don't look at the top. Look down here. Look underneath the explosion.
Yeah, that one, yeah.
Again and again, you see these big puffs of debris. Yeah. These are massive explosions going off. And you watch in a minute how far down the towers they are. People on the day, firemen, rescue workers, office staff, look how far down they are, said there were explosions going off in those buildings even before they began to collapse. And that's something I'll come back to in a second. When you then look at the testament, look how far down that is. Pressure wave up here. How is that happening?
Yep.
Look at the size of these explosions.
Shit.
It seems very clear that something's going on down below, which is taking out the structure to make sure that it all falls down in its own footprint. Now that sounds like a big claim, but consider this. Later on in the day, something very strange happened to this building. Now, never in history had any modern building fallen down due to fire, right? Bear that in mind. There was a classic case in 2005 of a hotel in Madrid that burnt for 24 hours and it didn't fall down. Because modern buildings are designed not to fall down, okay? Later on, at the World Trade Center, after all the towers had come down and the terrible day was on its way to ending, about 5:20 in the afternoon, all of a sudden, this building did this.
Pancaked.
Which is kind of odd, given that it was never hit by an aeroplane. You can understand, with the Twin Towers, there's some justification. Okay, you can see the damage, but hang on, why did this one come down? Well, the reason they say it came down was because the fires in it were so terrible. Let's have a look at the fires. The raging inferno in building number 7. There we go. If buildings collapsed due to this little fire, they should have evacuated the whole of Manhattan the next day, because they were all vulnerable. But funnily enough, that's never happened. When you look at the actual evidence, it is impossible to believe this fell down due to fire. Bearing in mind it was built to withstand many impacts from aeroplanes, it had the CIA headquarters in it, Mayor Giuliani's Emergency Management Agency headquarters in it. It had important stuff in this building that needed protecting. But one theory is that, in fact, this is where 9/11 was actually coordinated from, and that they had to take out the evidence at the end of the day. And there is a lot to say that that may well have been the case. And when you look at the footage closely again, just before it begins to fall, there's little puffs go off down the side, just like demolition. What was interesting was a number of 9/11 truthers took this footage and they took it to demolition experts and didn't tell them where it was taken. Because most people don't even know about Building 7. They've been programmed to forget that it ever happened. And they showed it to demolition experts who went, yep, that's obviously demolition. You know, where was this taken? And they said, no, it wasn't. It fell down due to fire. And they laughed. They said, no way. No, it's just impossible. That's demolition. So this is the problem. This gentleman here is William Rodriguez. Here being decorated by Mr. Bush as a hero, with good reason, because Rodriguez was the caretaker of the North Tower on the day of 9/11. I've met him, interesting man. He and his staff witnessed an explosion in the basement 30 seconds before the first plane hit. Okay, think about that for a moment. And then in the, of course, chaos when the planes hit, then, of course, you know, this was forgotten. When he and his staff tried to testify to the official 9/11 commission, guess what? Didn't want to know. Wouldn't include any of that testimony. The firemen didn't want to know. The firemen have been told to shut up, by the way. Paul Isaac is a fireman that's now helped found firefighters for 9/11 Truth, because he said we've all been basically ordered to shut up about what we saw that day and we're not having it anymore. So people are beginning to speak. And this is, of course, where we could go on and on. We won't, because we do sooner or later have to get a drink.
Then there was all the Thermosite dust as well, wasn't there?
I'm going to give you a few things to think about, we'll briefly say here. Why were no fighters ordered to intercept the hijacked planes until it was too late?
Yeah.
Did you know that in every hijack, in normal circumstances, they always send up fighters to escort the plane? Even in suspected hijack. None of that happened on 9/11. They let the planes come in. Now, there were exercises going on that day, and they said they were confused. They thought it was an exercise. Yeah, come on, when you look at the air traffic control records, they knew damn well these were real hijacks. When they did finally scramble planes, they flew them from the furthest base possible, too slowly, out to sea in the wrong direction. Come on, how stupid really are they? Not that stupid. Why did all the planes' transponders fail? The automatic beacons all got switched off. Never heard of in any previous hijack. They claim that's why they didn't know where the planes were. But that's a lie, because otherwise how would they ever have known when Russian bombers were coming in the 60s? You've got radars, what radars for? So even that's not accurate. What was the purpose of the World Trade Center's strange maintenance power downs in the days before the attacks? More than one member of staff reported that in a weekend, sniffer dogs were removed from the premises. Men came in with strange equipment. Nobody knows to this day what they were doing. Was that when they were planting the charges? Maybe.
There's a guy, do you know Scott Forbes?
It is indeed Scott Forbes, who, yes, I believe has a local connection, doesn't
he?
Yeah,
he lives in Kempton.
Yeah, there we go. Scott Forbes is one of those, yes, who's gone on the record with that. What was the significance of Marvin Bush, the president's brother, being responsible for the World Trade Center security management? Good beef, guys. That's an interesting one. Why was there unusual stock market insider trading in the days before 9/11? And boy, was there. Somebody knew exactly which companies were going to be hit and when. And they made a lot of money by basically putting put options on them. That is, betting that the stock of a particular company will go down. And they even knew which airlines were going to be hit. It's too much coincidence. So somebody had the word on exactly what was going to happen, and they used it to make money. Why did World Trade Center owner Larry Silverstein, who, by the way, denied that Building 7 was demolished, even though on the day he did imply that actually they had, which of course then opens a massive can of worms. But why did Larry Silverstein take out a destruction insurance policy just months, in fact weeks, in fact, before the attacks? Now, even when the World Trade Center got bombed in 1993, which everybody forgets now, nobody took out an insurance policy. But he did, and made billions. If steel does not weaken until 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, which doesn't, why did the towers fall if they didn't burn any more, and the official records say this, at no more than 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit? Even if you're taking into account burning carpets and jet fuel and God knows what, it couldn't have gone more than 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit. So the main contention, which is that fireproofing was removed from the supports, the metal supports, and that it melted, well not melted, but it weakened and then dragged the structure down, is just rubbish. Because no temperature got that high. And you can see most of the jet fuel, in any case, is burnt on the initial impacts. Yeah. Those are the big orange balls of flame you see. Most of the smoke from the towers is black and a very low temperature, relatively speaking. Low temperature fire. Shouldn't have been enough to weaken the structure. And why were nearly all objects pulverized to dust in the World Trade Center? You read testimony of rescue workers and firemen, and they say things like, what was amazing was, there were no filing cabinets, no telephones, nothing. It was just dust. White, toxic dust. And, as you've just said, analysis of the dust has shown tiny particles of thermite. And thermite is a substance used to make things burn bright and hot and fast. Yep. And some people think that was introduced in the explosives in the building, and there is footage clearly showing molten metal running down the sides of the towers. And that is not the result of burning carpets. And yet, funnily enough, the hijacker's passport survived the fireballs and were found on the pavements below. Isn't that a stroke of luck? Nothing else survived, but they did. By the way, some of the hijackers still claim they're alive, but hey, that's by the by. Why was the World Trade Center wreckage illegally removed before forensic examination? Why indeed? If you look at just one website, because we want to move on and conclude soon. If you look at one website, look at Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. Because these are professionals, academics, people that know their craft. And if you want to read some books, and I certainly urge that you do, there are many books out there. This stuff you can read in W.H. Smith. If you're going to read one book, read the works of David Ray Griffin, a Christian theologian in America whose reasoning is so impeccable and his logic so cool and relaxed that you just can't argue with many of the things he says.
Isn't he asking for a world government, though?
Not quite. No, that's much. No, that's not as much misquoted. We'll talk about that later. Much misquoted. But even so, you can't argue with his reasoning where he says clearly this was done by help in America. So what was it all about? Because, of course, 9/11 was used to justify the wars that we've had since, all the influence in the Middle East. Was Bin Laden involved or not involved? No. I think Al-Qaeda, as I say, probably were involved. But clearly there was a criminal cabal somewhere at work within America and probably beyond that made this happen. And the speculation about who, where and why is for another time. But of course, what was the massive spin-off from it was the world of surveillance and control and the loss of freedoms that we've had every year since. Off the back of 9/11, there were massive curtailments of basic liberties that we all used to take for granted. And all the things we spoke about earlier on have been hugely advanced by 9/11 and other things besides. But there is no question that it has certainly been used to justify all of these things. And also used to justify things like the strange, mysterious prison camps that are currently being built around the world. People looking at Google Earth started to think, what's that and that, and noticed big structures going up. And when finally quizzed in America, in particular, they said, yeah, yeah, they are, what do they call them, something like your safety camps or something, and they're empty and they could take thousands of people, and apparently they're there in case of an emergency. Now, you have to ask, what emergency are they expecting? Well, if you go back to where we began earlier on, seems so long ago now, of course we were talking about the prophecies and the predictions for these times. You see, you can bet your life that the kind of people that sit beneath giant stone owls and wear funny robes are going to know more about this than probably anybody else. They're very interested in the occult, they're very interested in ancient wisdom and prophecies. If they think there's even the slightest chance that there could be a truth to them, they're going to want to make damn sure that they stay on top if any cosmological event occurs. And cosmological events, I think, are probably what we're looking at. There are all sorts of theories about what the ancients were recording. Galactic superwaves, bands of energy passing away, there may be truth to that. And the first indication would be the sun and its behaviour. And indeed, the sun is behaving very out of kilter. In the last 15 years, it's broken records for sizes of solar flares, coronal mass ejections, sunspot activity, like nothing we've seen. And yet, in the last two or three years, it's gone mysteriously quiet, quieter than we've known in a long, long time. And many scientists are saying this could be the calm before the storm. And they're worried. And there's been a lot of high media mainstream coverage recently of the effects of one giant solar flare headed in the wrong direction, i.e. towards us. Because one enormous solar flare at the wrong moment could knock out the world's electrics like that. Bang! And if that happens, we're all going to be back to medieval times for a few months, maybe years, and we are not protected. NASA's trying to put together its solar shield project to encourage governments to bloody well protect their power grid. But either they're not because they don't want to, because they want a disaster, or they're just too stupid to see it coming. But those that know, that have got access to underground shelters and all of that, are clearly not so fussed. Now, you might conclude from all this that this is all a really bad thing. But here's the other side of the coin. So yes, big solar flares, it's going to happen sooner or later. You might as well get some bottled water and a few toilet rolls in anyway, because you just don't know, do you, what could happen tomorrow. But maybe when you look at the work carried out on the effects of electromagnetic waves on the human mind, this could lead to something that's also embedded in the ancient prophecies and the predictions. Because they all speak that at the other end of the changes, mankind will be in a higher state of consciousness. Now, when you look at the work of people like Rick Strassman and Dr. Michael Persinger and people like this, of the reaction of the human brain, and particularly the pineal gland, to enhance electromagnetic states, it can put people into whole higher states of being. And some people are saying that it's the very cycle we're going through of the sun that might take us to a new stage of evolution. There are clearly big changes going on, and I think we're seeing them socially, we're seeing them physically, we're seeing them spiritually. Yeah. If you're interested in astrology, you may also like to know that just astrology alone says that in the next two or three years you are going to see massive changes, freedom versus control in particular, and we're already seeing the beginning of that. And my partner Helen over there is an astrologer, and if you want to talk to her later on, she'll tell you more about this, because that alone, even if you knew nothing about the prophecies, means we're in for some whacking great changes. But here's the good news. When you look at the effect of the mind on the energetic environment around us and the effect of the energetic environment on the mind, there is an interaction. And it's real. If you look at the work of the Global Consciousness Project, which has been going on at Princeton University, you will find that they have been developing computers that react and respond to human thought. And what they found is when lots of people focus their minds on the same thing at the same time, okay, they can make these computers react more. And that is being used to show that mass consciousness works. Focus and intent could actually change the world around us. Now, we haven't got the time to say much more tonight. If you're curious, of course, there are lots of works out there. I would urge you to read, like, Jeff Stray's Beyond 2012. I've got a few copies there. And I can't even sell you one of these tonight, but the Truth Agenda book may be useful to you, which I've written to put much, much more of this than we've had time to say. There are some leaflets you can take. There's a new version that will be out next month. But there's some copies you can flick through there if you're curious. But to end on a really importantly high note, I just want to say this for the last few minutes. Those that say, and there are, yes, but we can't do anything about this, it's too big, are not looking back through history. History records when people stand up in their power and they decide to focus their intent and their thoughts and match it with action, the world changes. For example, genetically modified food has been massively held back in Britain by people saying no. And companies like Monsanto that have really struggled to push this stuff on people. Now, sadly, it's coming in through the back door, courtesy of things like Codex Alimentarius and food safety bodies that are allowing more GM, less organic, and also restricting natural health supplements. If you don't know about the Codex Alimentarius, look up either the National Health Federation website or the Alliance for Natural Health, because there's a lot of stuff going on with that. But it has nonetheless, by people standing their ground, it's been difficult for GM to be pushed on us. Even if you take a slightly small example, like the campaign for real ale, that's been a very good example. When people stand up, they've saved independent breweries and pubs from going down the pen by getting people to stand up for themselves. And it works. Shame it takes alcohol to galvanise people sometimes, but nonetheless. Now, you could argue that peace protests don't work. Because you could say, well, yeah, look, you know, C&D and you know, millions, they took to the streets in 2003 to protest about the Iraq war. And it didn't work. I would argue slightly differently. I would say that if people hadn't made their feelings known here, the world we live in could be a lot worse. And, for instance, if people hadn't made their feelings known about what went on in Iraq, we probably would have been bombing Iran 3 years ago. Because they still feel the need to, as Noam Chomsky says, manufacture our consent. They still need us to support them to a certain degree, and that's why they have to create the fear to make us back them, and we have to stop giving them that fear.
Absolutely.
So when we stand up and make a point, it does register with them, and I believe it makes the world better. Look back through history. Some examples. The Berlin Wall. Now, yes, it was politically convenient by this point for it to come down. That's true. But still, it happened much faster and in a completely different way because people lost their fear and suddenly they stood up and said, enough of this! And they faced the guns and suddenly the guns stood down. And you know how the world changed from that point onwards because people stood up and stopped fearing. Another example, the suffragette movement. Ladies, you can vote! Once you couldn't, once people had to throw themselves under horses to make a point. Now the problem you've got is finding somebody you want to vote for. But that's a different story. But, you know, people, blah, by gum, they suffered. But it worked. When enough people stick their heads above the parapet and stand up for what they believe in the end, change comes. Another example, Nelson Mandela. Now, some people have an issue and say, he was a terrorist. Well, whatever, you would never have thought after all those years of incarceration that he would have gone on to become president of South Africa. Nobody saw that coming. But there was a focusing of global consciousness on his case and on the issue. And in the end, the South African government was shamed into releasing him. And look what a change has come since. So things you think can never change suddenly do. Solidarity in Poland, they stood up for their rights for nigh on a decade against, you know, basically totalitarian oppression. And they weren't supposed to have a union, but they insisted. And in the end, though it was long and hard, they formed the first democratic government Poland had had for years. Another example, Live Aid. Now, it's easy to be cynical about charity concerts these days, but there's no question that Live Aid said to the world, look what can be done with the technology and with mass consciousness. And there was a real, genuine intent of something positive in there that rippled around the world. There's no question about that at all. And people shamed the governments by saying, all right, you're not doing enough, we'll do something. And it was a very good example. the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. Now, some again say, oh, yes, but that was conspiracy manipulation. Well, maybe it was. But the intent of the people was real. They believed in what they were doing. Thousands took to the streets and stood their ground to basically contest a clearly rigged election. And in the end, they overturned the election. Tanks rolled in, there was a standoff, and the tanks rolled back. Now, listen, Ukraine has managed to get itself into all sorts of problems since, but it was an example. It doesn't always work. Tiananmen Square, bad example. But Egypt, they've still got a military junta in control, in essence. But it's a start. It's a start. God knows what's going to happen in Libya. But nonetheless, history shows more often than not, actually, it does work. And did you think you would ever see this? Paisley and Adams in Northern Ireland sitting at a table grinning together. The Northern Ireland situation is very emotive and very difficult when you look back at its history. But you would never have thought that this could ever happen. It did happen. Because enough people focused their consciousness and stood up for saying, no, enough is enough. And they're on the road to something. Long way to go, but that goes to show how change can occur. And at the moment, people are trying to reach into themselves for change on every level. And have you noticed how people also are hungry for a spiritual shift too? When I say spiritual, you can interpret that any way you like. But I thought the best evidence we've had for that was the recent success of the film Avatar.
Yeah.
Now, I imagine many of you will have seen it. If you haven't, I'd say go and see it. It's not the best film ever made, but there is a reason why it's the most successful film ever made. And the reason is that it managed to conjure up a world that was so real to people, so beautiful, so as they want their world to be, that they couldn't bear not to live in it. If you haven't seen it, these people live in a kind of collective consciousness state in perfect harmony with their environment and nature, and of course mankind turns up and tries to destroy it all, as we do. But the parable was that people standing up for these connections, you know, this is important, it works. People came out of the cinema after seeing this, and you may have heard this in the news, particularly in America, and committed suicide.
You're joking?
No, not joking. And the reason they did was because there were some people who had seen a world that was so right that they couldn't actually cope with the real world they lived in. Now, that's too extreme a response, but it goes to show how this film touched hearts. And yet, as the director James Cameron has said, he said, yeah, but I made it, don't you get it, as a parable. I'm trying to show you that Pandora, the planet Pandora, is Earth.
Yeah.
This is our world. You can have this back if enough of you want it. He said that.
Yeah.
And it's true. And what it's done is help draw people back to realise they need more than what they're being fed at the moment. And they're finding more. And that's the key thing. And here's a quote from Gandhi to bear in mind. Okay. And Gandhi once said this. He said, when I despair, I remember that all through history, the ways of truth and love have always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Remember that? Always. And you know what? He's definitely right. And if we are puppets of conspiracies and ruling elites and illuminatis and God knows what, guess what? It's only because we've let it happen. And if enough people stood up tomorrow and said that enough, it would end. Because we are the most extraordinary things around. Now here's the irony. Those trying to control us know how powerful we are. We, collectively, have forgotten. We've been lulled into apathy, we've been lulled into disempowerment, thinking we can't make a difference, but we can. And there are many examples around us showing us that we can. And it may take courage and bravery, and I'm not just talking about taking to the streets. By the way, mob rule is no answer. Peaceful, philosophical demonstration, perhaps, yes. There has to be a revolution in the heart before there's going to be a revolution that changes the world. You've got to change yourself, because the collective is only an expression of what we all are.
Yeah.
And those that lead us are simply products of ourselves. When we own that, you'll see the change start to happen more quickly. And it involves talking to the people in your lives, your family, the people you work with, about the issues you're concerned with, without fear of ridicule. Forget fear. Go for it. Tomorrow, and you turn up wherever you work or whatever, why don't you tell them what you sat and the guff you listened to tonight? Why don't you tell them? Go on, I dare you. Get the conversation going. And what might surprise you is actually more people will agree with you. When they get over the thing of thinking, will anybody ridicule them? More people will actually be in resonance with at least some of it than you think.
Absolutely.
And that's the thing. We've been fooled into thinking we live in a world where we're the minority. No, we're not. No, we're not. Most people actually think in a very alternative way, but it's simply not reflected in the world around us. So I hope that what I've managed to do tonight is just to feed you some ideas, some food for thought, and basically just to encourage you to think there actually are some threads that do pull together, that do make some sense, and that we can definitely make a difference if we choose to. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
Where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.